Okay. So, let's see. Right, so this is the third lecture. Remember, the fourth lecture does not happen tomorrow. My last lecture will of this series will happen on Monday. Okay. So, remember, in the first lecture, I posed a lot of problems and stated just one theorem. Then yesterday came two of the simplest ideas that enter into the solution. I thought that I should at least start today by stating several of the main theorems. Okay, and then I'd like to give an application to one of the computer science problems, and well, we'll see how far we get. I have been so far pretty bad at estimating how far we get in a given lecture. All right. So let's say in this blackboard, I'm going to be talking about the CM norm. And on this blackboard, I'm going to be talking about the Sobolev norm, WMP of Rn, M derivatives in LP. Okay? The presence of this blackboard is the new feature of the lecture. Some of you may have heard isomorphic copies of Charlie lectures over all too many years, but finally, after several years of struggle, there is something new, and it's this. Okay. All right. This is joint work with Boaz Klartag, and this is joint work with Aryeh Israel. And Garvin or Kevin Lully. Okay. Now, all right. So just by way of preparation, here, if I write C or C or C prime, these are constants depending only on M and N. And here, these are constants depending only on M, N, and P. In other words, on the function space we choose to work in. All right. Now, I'm only going to be talking about extension problems from finite sets today. If we make enough progress today, then infinite sets will happen on Monday. Okay, if we make tremendous progress today, infinite sets will already happen today. But for the moment, I'm only talking about finite sets. Furthermore, I'm imposing a zero tolerance rule. Remember, on Monday, I made a point of saying that we approximate data. We fit data only approximately. We needn't fit perfectly. There is this tolerance sigma of x. I'm going to set that sigma of x to zero. In order to simplify things. So I'm going to be asking today about fitting a function perfectly to data rather than up to a given tolerance. Here, that's only for simplicity of exposition. All the theorems here go over to the case in which we're trying to fit data approximately. Here, the theorems are quite new. One of my tasks of the moment is to nitpick the draft of the moment of the paper proving the theorems are going to state, and these theorems are right now only proven for the case of zero tolerance. I think they can be extended there's a version for fitting data approximately, but not only am I not going to talk about it today, it hasn't been proven yet. Okay. Here, in this setting, I'm always going to assume that P is greater than N. And the reason for that is that the Sobolev theorem then guarantees that any function here has M minus 1 continuous derivatives. Okay? There is no reason to assume that P is greater than N. All we need to do in the ideal world in which we've solved all worthwhile problems, we should be able to talk about this for any Sobolev space all of whose functions are at least continuous. Okay, but today, as of what we can prove, p is greater than the dimension. Okay, so those are the preliminaries. Okay, now the first thing I'd like to describe is the finiteness principle. Oh wait, so no, still more notation. Let's say E in Rn is a finite set, and n is the number of points of E, always. All right. Cm of E is the set of all restrictions, so that F is in Cm of Rn. Well, that's ridiculous. That means all real valued functions on E, because E is finite. But if F is a real valued function on E, its norm in Cm of E is defined to be the inf of the Cm norm of F over all F in Cm, such that F agrees perfectly with F on E, on little f on E. Okay? So that's the space. And similarly, the norm of F in WMP of E is the inf of the Sobolev norms WMP of functions, such that F, so F is in WMP, and F equals F perfectly on E. Okay. I'm sorry, now I think all the preliminaries are done, and now let me start stating theorems. Okay, so the first theorem that I'd like to state here is the finiteness principle. To give you an orientation, let me state the original finiteness principle of Brudny and Schwarzman from the 1970s. So suppose that we're looking at, let's say, C2 of R2. And I want to stress that the theorem that I'm about to state is true for arbitrarily large finite sets, but is false for infinite sets. Infinite sets create a new layer of difficulty requiring new ideas. Okay. So we're in C2 of R2. E is finite. Well, there it is. It's finite. Suppose that F is a function from E to R. And suppose that if you look at F restricted to S, a subset S, and then we look at its C2 norm on S, suppose this is less than or equal to 1 for every S contained in E with at most 6 points. Okay. Then, so we assume that. Then F in C2 of E is less than or equal to some explicit universal constant. That's the original Brudny-Schwarzman finiteness principle for C2 of R2. They had a more general version in which instead of R2, there's Rn. 6 is replaced by a rather odd number. By a rather strange number. So the number is, let's see, so if we're in Rn, 6 is replaced by 3 times 2 to the n minus 1, and that number is sharp. C2 only. So they have, I would say, the sharpest methods for C2, or in fact, for any space which is no stronger than C2. But their methods appear not to go beyond C2. Okay. Now, for purposes of calculating anything, this sort of thing is great, because we saw last time that thanks to the Whitney extension theorem, we can calculate the order of magnitude of the CM norm of a function on 6 points or on 11 points or whatever, as long as we have a bound on the size of the set. But there are an awful lot of 6-point sets. There are n to the 6th of these endpoint sets, and if think about how many points. I mean, think of how many subsets there are with at most that many points. And so we need to do something more. And so the first theorem that I'd like to state is the sharp version of the finiteness principle. So here's the finiteness principle. Okay, given E, there exist, so again, E is contained in Rn, it's finite, n is the number of points. There exist subsets. So now instead of looking at all little subsets, we're going to make a list of little subsets. So the subsets are S1, S2, SL, contained in E, such that the following hold. So the first thing that holds is that each one of these sets has only a bounded number of points in it. Okay, so this would be 6 in the original Rudin-Schwarzman theorem. Okay? So the second point is that the number of these guys, that's L, right? How many of these little subsets do we have to look at? That's less than or equal to a constant times n, the number of points of E. So the number of subsets is linear in the size of E. Okay? And then the claim is that for any, now so far I only have the set E. Now I'm going to introduce the function F. So for any function F mapping E to R, we have the inequality that the norm of F in CM of E is less than or equal to the maximum of the norms of F restricted to these SL in CM of SL. And here L equals 1 to capital L. I'm sorry? Oh. Thank you. Thank you. Okay? So that means that in order to calculate this norm, it's enough to calculate each of these norms, which can be done in linear time. Now, that's all very nice, provided you know these sets, but we need to calculate them. And so the next point regarding these sets is that the list of subsets S1, S2, SL can be computed using at most CN log N computer operations and storage less than or equal to CN memory cells. Okay? So these things can be quickly computed, and then once you have them, then you can quickly compute the norm of a function, the order of magnitude of the norm of a function. So this is the first theorem. Okay? This lets you compute the order of magnitude of the norm of a function. Okay. Now, what the hell is the analog of that for Sobolev spaces? And so the small community of people working on these problems tried various things and nothing worked. And finally, here is the analog. At least here is an analog. So here, the theorem is the following. Given E, Rn finite, sharp of E, number of points of E equals N, there exist linear functionals C1, to see L from L M P, I'm sorry, W M P of E into R, right, linear functionals, such that for any F we have the inequalities that a constant times the maximum from L equals 1 to L of the linear functionals applied to F. This quantity is less than or equal to the norm of F in W M P of E, and that's less than or equal to a constant, a bigger constant times the same maximum. Okay, and furthermore, L is less than or equal to C times N. Okay? Now, there is an additional property of these functionals that I hope I will have time to explain. These functionals are suppose that you have a finite set E. Think of the vector space of all functions on E. Think of a linear functional on that. What does it look like? Well, C of F is the sum over all points X in E of some coefficient lambda of X times F of X. That's what a linear functional looks like. And to first approximation, lots and lots and lots of these coefficients, lambda X, are zero. Only a bounded number of them are non-zero. The way I've stated it, that's false, but something like that is true. Enough is true so that if I give you a particular F, you can compute all of these values, C1 of F through CL of F, using O of N computer operations. If you had the most general linear functional here, E has N points, this sum has N terms, to compute a single one of these guys would take about N computer operations, and so to compute this many fellows would take about N squared computer operations. But because of a certain sparsity property, in which, roughly speaking, almost all of these coefficients are zero, the fact is that these fellows can be computed quickly. The sparsity of these linear functionals is closely related to the fact that these sets are little. Okay. Does that make any sense at all? I would propose to abandon this for the moment and go on to the next set of theorems. Okay. So I want to state the theorems. So here we've got we've done the finiteness principle, which lets you compute the order of magnitude of the norm in the CM case, and we have the existence of these linear functionals, which lets you compute the order of magnitude of the norm in the Sobolev case. Okay. All right. Now let's think, how can we construct an extension? Okay. So now let me erase the board here, and now let me just state the next theorem. So, given E contained in Rn finite, there exists a linear extension operator, that is, there exists a linear map T mapping CM of E to CM of Rn such that, first of all, TF is equal to F on E for every F in CM of E. Okay, so TF extends F from the set E where it was originally defined to the whole Rn, and does so in a linear manner. Okay, and furthermore, the norm of TF in CM of Rn is less than or equal to a constant C, depending only on which function space we're working in, times F of times the norm of F in CM of E. In other words, so T is a bounded operator. In other words, this interpolant has CM norm as small as possible within a factor of capital C. Capital C depends only on little m and little n. Okay? Furthermore, this T also has a sparsity property so that it can be efficiently computed. So T in some sense can be efficiently computed. So remember, well, you may possibly remember the theorem from the first lecture in which I said that there exists a function which can be computed efficiently, et cetera, et cetera. That function is in fact given by this linear operation T. Okay? Similarly here, the theorem is the same. Okay? So there exists, except with WMP. So, same thing. So, given E, Rn finite, n points, there exists a linear map T taking WMP of E to WMP of Rn such that TF equals F on E and norm TF WMP of Rn is less than or equal to a constant norm F WMP of E, and this happens for all F in WMP of E. Okay, so in each case there's a linear extension operator whose norm is bounded by some constant that only depends on little m and P. Okay. All right, finiteness principles, linear extension operators. Let me describe an algorithm that computes the convex sets gamma, about which I will first remind you. They're from the first lecture. Okay. So, all right. Okay, so we're given F takes E to R, and in terms of this, we want to compute the set gamma of XM, which is the set of all jets at X of functions F. Remember, this jet is just the Taylor polynomial of functions F, such that the norm of F in CM of Rn is less than or equal to M, and F equals F on E. In the Monday lecture, there was some inequality with a sigma in place of this, but I said, you know, in view of the zero tolerance policy, that's what gamma is. So the problem is, compute this guy. And I can't compute it exactly, but I can compute its approximate size and shape, by which I mean the following. Okay, we will compute different convex sets gamma sharp of XM. What does it mean to compute a convex set? Well, a convex set is, let's say, given by a finite family of linear constraints. So that, at least this one will be. So this is contained in script P, which, remember, is the vector space of all, let's say, nth degree polynomials on Rn. So this is what we're going to compute, and it's going to be guaranteed that these gamma sharps are comparable to the gammas in the sense that gamma of, let's see, gamma sharp of x little cm is contained in gamma of xm is contained in gamma of x big cm. Little c and big c depend only on little m and little n, the dimension of the Rn and how many derivatives. I'm sorry?
Sharp,
thank you. Thank you. Okay. So this is the goal, to do such a thing. Okay. Let me describe the algorithm. Okay, so first, remember, all right, I hope this rings, I hope this jogs your memory, and so the claim is this is an important thing. This answers the question, okay, if we can make the interpolation, how non-unique is it? What can we actually say about the interpolant? Remember the little discussion of the car trip. Okay, so this is a guy we want to compute, and I'd like to explain an algorithm to compute it. Now, in fact, this can be computed very efficiently. These convex sets depend on an X and an M. So these depend on an X and an M, so there are infinitely many convex sets that we might want to calculate. But in fact, one can look at the set E and do n log n computer operations of work, after which we are in good shape, we have the information we need, and then if I tell you X and M, then you can calculate gamma sharp of XM in log n steps, okay, in log n computer operations. So these things can be computed very efficiently. I'm not going to show you that algorithm. I'm going to show you an inefficient algorithm that takes much, much more work than that, far more computer operations. I will describe it, and then I will tell you how it's improved, and then we'll take a break. Sure. Yes.
Let's
see. Yes, so these gamma sharp might easily be empty.
It can be empty.
I do not claim that it's non-empty. So for it, right, if you have, if you have that kind of data, and I ask you for the jets, what can you say about the jet of an interpolant of that with C5 norm at most a half? Well, there are no such interpolants, and the gamma sharp is the empty set. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. I should have said that. Okay? Okay, I'd like to describe the algorithm. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a simple procedure which computes things that I'll call gamma L of XM. So L here is an index 0, 1, 2, etc. Okay? And we're going to construct these guys by induction on L. Each one of these will be a convex set in P, possibly empty. Convex, possibly empty. Okay? And they will have the following features. First of all, gamma L of XM is going to contain gamma of XM. So these guys are going to be computed. This guy we don't yet know. But these guys will be too big. but they will get smaller. Gamma L plus 1 of XM contains, gamma L contains gamma L plus 1 of XM. So they're too big, but they're getting smaller. And at some point, we're going to stop and declare victory. And at that point, the gamma that we compute will be comparable to the real gamma. That's the plan. Okay? Now, what are these things? Well, I'm defining them by induction on L, so let's start with L equals 0. So here's gamma 0 of XM. It's the set of all polynomials P in this vector space script P that satisfy two properties. First of all, P at this given point X is equal to the value f of X. Oh, I should say, these things are well defined for all X in Rn, but just for expository purposes in the lecture, let me restrict attention to X in E. Okay? So this makes sense. And furthermore, we have these inequalities. Okay? Now, that's very explicit. It's a convex set. It's given by a list of linear constraints. And it obviously contains the true gamma, because the true gamma consists of jets of interpolants. An interpolant satisfies f of x equals little f of x. And an interpolant satisfies that the alpha derivative of capital F of x is less than or equal to m, because that's what those are the conditions we demand on F. So this gamma zero arises from precisely the information that we have only at the single point X. If we were to ignore all the information we have from any other point, that information would be that our interpolant has to have a jet in there. But of course, other points are going to provide information, and so we're going to have to pass information from one point to another. So this statement is obvious for L equals zero. Okay. But now I want to pass from L to L plus one. So now imagine that I have already defined, so I fix L greater than or equal to zero, and suppose we've already defined a convex set gamma L of XM containing the true gamma, which we still don't know, for each X in E. And now our immediate goal is to define gamma L plus 1 of XM for all X in E. And we want to do that in such a way that these two properties hold. Okay? All right. Now, the definition is very simple, but nevertheless, I'd like to take a minute and motivate it. All right. Let's erase Sobolev spaces. So the remark is the following. Suppose that I have a function f, and its CM norm is at most capital M. Let's take two points, x and y, Rn, and let's let P be the jet of f at x, the Taylor polynomial at x, and let P prime be the Taylor polynomial of f at y. Of course, if x is close to y, then p is close to p prime. How close? Well, the answer comes from Taylor's theorem with remainder. It's a trivial estimate, which I will write down. Partial alpha of p minus p prime at, let's say, x is less than or equal to m times x minus y to the m minus alpha for alpha less than or equal to m. Okay? I'm sorry? No, no, it's m. It's m. Right, so if you take the highest derivative, this is the zeroth power, and this is just less than or equal to m because they're both separately less than or equal to m. I left out a factor of 2. In general, there's some constant. I'm sorry? Yes. Well, one is at most m, and the other one is at one is at most m in absolute value. The other is at most m in absolute value. We subtract them, and it's at most 2m in absolute value. And here, when alpha, we're taking the highest derivatives. So then this is m minus m. That's the zeroth power. This is 1. This is capital M. I'm off by a factor of 2. Yes, I'm off by a factor. All right, there. Okay. Oh, that's all. Okay. Yes. No. I agree. I'm off by that constant. Okay. So this is Taylor's theorem. All right. So now I want to use that to. All right. So let me make a corollary for the true gamma. Okay. For the true gamma, suppose P is in gamma of x m. Okay. And suppose that y is in Rn. Then there exists P prime in the true gamma of YM such that this inequality holds. Okay, why? Suppose that P is in gamma of XM. That means that P is the jet at X of some interpolant. Well, let us take P prime to be the jet at Y of the same interpolant. Then this little remark implies the corollary. So this is a very obvious thing. There's nothing in it except Taylor's theorem. Okay, and it helps for it to be right. So thank you. We put the constant C there. Okay? So now let me define this, and I'm going to define gamma L plus 1 of XM, and it's going to be the set of all P in gamma L of XM, such that for all y in E, there exists P prime in gamma L of y m, such that those estimates hold. D alpha of P minus P prime x less than or equal to that constant C m x minus y to the m minus alpha. No, this is for all, what did I say? No, for all y and e. So again, this is just the expository version of the algorithm, and in the expository version of the algorithm, I'm only defining these things when x is in e. Okay? So notice that I regard this guy and each of these guys as already known, and therefore this guy is known. So this is a known convex set which one can calculate. Let's check these properties. This property is obvious because gamma L plus 1 is defined to be the set of all P in gamma L such that something or other. This property is obvious because if I have any polynomial P in the true gamma, I need to show it belongs to here. Well, I know by inductive hypothesis that it belongs to here. And furthermore, for every y, there is a p prime in the true gamma for which this is true, and by inductive hypothesis, the true gamma is contained in the gamma L, thanks to the corollary. And so both of these properties are obvious by induction on L. A small point. Sure.
Why is this p prime an interpolant?
Oh, no. Okay. So I have to produce a P prime and show that it belongs to the true gamma. Okay? How can I produce? So this is an existence statement, not a construction. Okay. Sup- suppose that P is in the gamma of XM. What does that mean? It means there is an interpolant. There is a function, capital F, whose CM norm is at most capital M, and which agrees with the data perfectly, little f, okay, and whose jet at X is equal to P. Okay? Now I would like to find, now I take that interpolant, I have no idea what it is, but there is one, that's what it means for P to be in gamma. I take that interpolant, and I take its jet at Y. Then it belongs to gamma of YM, because there is an interpolant, namely the same one that I picked for X, and the jet of that interpolant at Y is P prime, and therefore P prime belongs to the gamma for Y. Thank you for asking. So there's actual interest in understanding what's going on. Thank you. Okay. So we have now defined the gamma L plus one. And an unpleasant feature of this process, the way I have defined it, is that these convex sets are obviously getting more and more complicated, and it's more and more computationally intensive to manipulate them. But that's okay. We don't need to deal with exactly these convex sets. We can approximate them. So there's some elementary discussion of convex sets. Given a convex set, you can find a comparable convex set with not too many defined by not too many linear constraints. That's a discussion having nothing to do with, really, with the, I mean, that's just a basic fact about convex sets. I want to ignore that point. Okay. So let's just regard a convex set as a thing, and we don't worry about how complicated it is to manipulate things. We can do it. Okay. what are we doing? What have we accomplished so far? And the answer is that we have we are trying to compute gammas, and instead we have computed these gamma sub L, and they are too big, but they are getting smaller. Okay, now comes the theorem. And so the theorem is that there exists some constant L star depending only on little m and little n. Remember, always, we're working in CM of Rn, that's what little m and little n are. There exists an L star depending on only on these guys, such that, all right, now, we know that gamma L star contain of Xm contains the true gamma of Xm. That's trivial. I mean, there it is. But here's the serious content of the theorem. This in turn contains gamma L star of X and a small constant times M. Okay. That, if you believe this theorem, then we have succeeded in calculating our gamma sharp, namely our gamma sharp is simply gamma sub L star. Okay. So the C capital is 1. Yes. Yes.
And then we need to include this M, but the 1 over C, right? 1 over C small.
I'm sorry.
I mean, well, if it's too sharp to them, then this CM will be empty presumably.
Oh, yes.
If you increase M by 1 over C.
Yes. 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 So it may happen. So for instance, if this guy is empty, we know that this guy is empty. Okay, if this guy is empty, we don't know whether this guy is empty or not. This means that, for instance, we could use these as a tool to find the order of magnitude of the least m for which there is an interpolant, and we won't find exactly the least m, but we'll find its order of magnitude. Okay, this algorithm. All right, so first of all. yes, this algorithm works, but it's highly inefficient. And there's a very simple reason why it's highly inefficient. In the induction step, every y talks to every x, right? to define gamma L plus 1 of x, we have to look at every y in E. So the number of computer operations we need to do in order to carry this out can never be less than n squared. That's the number of pairs of points, x to be talked to and y to talk to them. Okay? So this algorithm is hopelessly inefficient. It takes n squared steps. And so what one has to do is to modify this algorithm using the well-separated pairs decomposition. This is somewhat analogous to the idea of computing the Lipschitz norm of a function. It's a much more complicated thing, but for instance, the baby version of this is compute the Lipschitz norm of a given function. And if you compute the Lipschitz norm of a given function, you would think that every y has to be compared with every x, and you would think that you have to use n squared steps, but in fact you can get away with n log n steps, provided you're willing to make a 1% error. And that's done by the well-separated pairs decomposition. Fitting the well-separated pairs decomposition into this is not so straightforward, but it can be done. Okay. And so there's a more efficient version of this algorithm, which takes only n log n computer operations. Okay. Furthermore, once you understand the proof of this theorem, or let's say of the modified version of this theorem that has the well-separated pairs decomposition, that essentially contains all of the theorems that I stated for CM of Rn. Once you understand this, you understand the picture. So sometime, maybe in the last lecture, maybe I will sketch the proof of some of the ideas of the proof of this theorem. Okay. All right. I think now would be a nice time to take a break. Let's meet again, let's say, at when that clock says, what do you think, half past? When that clock, a little bit, let me say a little bit before half past so that it actually happens at half past. And then I would like to show you a nice application of these theorems, namely, we'll go back to computer science, and I'm going to show you how to discard outliers. Remember, we wanted, on Monday, we wanted to fit data we have data, and we would like to be able to discard a few of the data points as outliers in order to bring down the CM norm of the interpolant. How to do that? So I'll show you when we meet. Okay. Okay, is the microphone turned back on? Okay, good. Okay, let's discard outliers. So we've got, we're working in CM of Rn, these things denote constants, etc. E is a finite set, F is a function from E to the reals, okay? And we look at F CM of E. But damn it, this is too big because there are some outliers. So what we're looking for is this. We're given some number K, which is, let's say, small compared to N, but maybe big compared to 1. Okay, that's the number of outliers. And given that, we want to discard K up to K points. So we want to discard the points of S contained in E, where S has at most K points. And we would like to make the norm of F in CM of E minus S as small as possible. And the question is how to pick S. Now, this question strikes me as very, very hard, maybe NP hard, and so I am not going to answer it, but instead I'd like to show you an easier version of the question, which still carries, I think, an interesting percentage of the oomph of the question, and we will answer that. Okay? So here's what we're going to do. There's going to be an unfair competition. So there's going to be RS, and there's going to be the best S, which we never, let's call it S hat. No, maybe RS will be S hat, and there's the best S, and we will never know this one. It's maybe very hard to find, but we will produce this guy. RS will have the property that it contains at most C times K points. So we've cheated. We've taken 100 times as many points as we were supposed to. Whereas the best S contains at most K points. It follows the rules. Okay? furthermore, the judging of our S versus the best S is also entails a certain amount of cheating because I will say our S hat wins if the norm of F when you discard S hat is less than or equal to C times the norm of F in CM of E minus S. Okay? You have perfect knowledge of the entire universe. I'm executing my little computer algorithms. I produce S hat, you produce S, but I get to cheat in two ways. First of all, my S hat maybe has 100 times as many points as your S. And furthermore, if my CM norm after I discard S hat is 10 times as big as your CM norm, I declare that I win. Okay, so this is the unfair competition. But, all right, so what we're going to do is our easier problem is to produce an S hat that wins the unfair competition. Okay, and there is, so it seems to me that already that is not an easy problem, and it seems to me that that is an interesting problem. Okay, so I would like to show you as an application of the theorems from an hour ago, I'd like to show you how to win the unfair competition. So there's going to be, so here's the theorem. It's possible to order, so let's say to enumerate the set E as E equals, let's say, a first element and a second element and a third element and so on, in such a way that X1 is the most meddlesome priest, okay, and this is the second most meddlesome and this is the third most meddlesome and so on, in such a way that for any K, if we pick S hat equals the set of X1 through XC times K, then this S hat wins the unfair competition.
For any K?
Competition for any K. Furthermore, we can compute X1, we can compute this ordering to Xn in n squared log n computer operations. Okay, now before, whenever I told you an algorithm, I was strongly convinced in the pit of my stomach that it could not be improved, that if something took n log n steps, it cannot be done in less than that. I don't have a proof, but it seems very clear. here I have no such feeling in the pit of my stomach. Perhaps this can be improved. I see no reason at all to believe that n squared, never mind the log factor, I see no reason to believe that n squared is the best possible, but I'm already surprised that it's possible to look at all, I mean, suppose that K is 150, so you get to discard 150 points, although I get to discard C times 150 points, so there are N times 150 possibilities to worry about, and yet you can figure out the answer to all such problems in N squared work, N squared log N work. Alright, let me explain how you do this. Okay? So why should this be true? All right, so let me tell you the algorithm. I'm going to pick these points C at a time. C is a large constant depending only on little m and little n. I'll pick the first C, then I'll remove them, and I'll look at all the rest, and then I'll pick the next C, and then I'll remove them, and I'll look at all the rest, and so on. Okay? Yes. Oh, no, oh, God, no. No, 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 no. Given F, yes, yes, right. I mean, yes, it must be dependent on F. Suppose that I show you a bunch of data, they all lie on a smooth curve, except one of them is somewhere completely different. That's the outlier. That depends on the F. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, alright, what do we do? Well, we use the sharp form of the finiteness principle. So remember that the norm of FCM of E is comparable, I'm going to use this symbol, it means up to a constant, you know, inequalities, one is less than or equal to the other times a constant C. This is comparable to the max, L equals 1 to capital L, of the norm of the restriction of F to SL in CM of SL. And each SL is small. Okay? Now, each one of these guys can be computed. Well, I can't compute it perfectly, but I can compute its order of magnitude. This is an expository talk, so let's not worry about that. Let's pretend I can compute it perfectly. So I compute each one of these, and I see which one is the biggest. Aha, that's the troublemaker. I will discard it. Now that I've discarded, let's say that S105 is the biggest. If there's a tie for first place, I just pick one of them. Okay? So I look at S105, and it has at most C elements, and I order them in any way, X1 through XC. Okay, now I've picked my first C elements. Now I simply look at E minus S105, and I look at F restricted to that. And now, again, I want to discard the most troublesome points of E minus S105. And so I just do the same thing. I apply the same algorithm to E minus S105. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So at every step, this whole family of SL will change and therefore has to be recomputed. And so one natural question to ask is, if I take E and simply remove a few points from it, does that really change the collection of this of these S's so completely that they have to be recomputed from scratch? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Okay, because to do one step of this requires n log n work, and we've discarded, let's say, 50 points. So we keep going until we... So that's the extra n. Okay? That's the algorithm. Why does it work? Well, let's do the unfair competition. So here's the S, secretly picked by God. All right. So sharp of S is less than or equal to K. And we want to remove S. And so we are looking at the the norm of F restricted to E minus S. And we look at that in CM of E minus S. Now let's ask whether removing S has done any good. So there are two possibilities. One possibility is that this is much smaller than F CM of E. I mean here less than a small constant times. That's what this symbol means. Okay? Maybe this is less than a small constant times this, or maybe not. If not, then we would have this situation. Okay? This would mean that these may be the best outliers to discard, but discarding them doesn't buy us anything. I just want to make the point that in this case, we are guaranteed to win the unfair competition, because it doesn't matter which outliers are discarded. Well, if this is the very best one to discard, it doesn't matter. You can't change the norm. You just can't. So God discards God's outliers, I discard my outliers, God does better, but I'm cheating, and so I declare that I've won. Okay? All right. So that's not an interesting case. The interesting case is the case in which there are outliers, in which it is possible to discard a few outliers, and we have made real progress. Okay. Now, let us compare this unknown set S with these fellows, with these S sub L's. Remember, these are little sets. I claim that my troublesome set S105 must contain at least one point of S. Why? Suppose not. Suppose that S and S105 are completely disjoint. Okay? Then let me look at, I know that this guy is equal to F restricted to S105 in CM of S105. That's one of the terms. The maximum is this one. Okay? So this fellow is comparable to this fellow. Aha. But if S and S105 were disjoint, then it would follow that S105 is contained in E minus S. And therefore, this is trivially less than or equal to F restricted to E minus S, CM of E minus S norm. Right. This inequality is obvious simply because it's harder to interpolate at more points than it is to interpolate at a subset of the points, at fewer points. Aha. So the CM norm of E, the CM norm for the whole problem is guaranteed up to this constant to be less than or equal to the CM norm of what happened for the very best set of outliers to be thrown out. But we're assuming that it is possible to make some progress by throwing out outliers, so that doesn't happen. Okay? Therefore, my set S105 must contain at least one of the points of S. Now, from God's set S, I discard one point. I discard at least one point. Namely, I discard the intersection of S with, I discard the intersection of S with S105. So I have discarded anywhere from 1 to 1,000 points of S. But I've discarded at least one point of S. From my own set S hat, I discard my S105. Those were the first C points. And I have now arrived at the same situation as before, with the same unfair competition as before, stacked in exactly the same way, but a smaller version of the problem. And so by induction, this works. At each stage, either it is simply impossible to reduce the norm anymore, and therefore it doesn't matter what we do or what God does, we have picked out 100 points, at least one of which is in God's S, and we make progress. That's it. Not necessarily best possible, but it works. Okay, so that's the application. I think now is a reasonable time to quit. So now for the last lecture on Monday, I think I owe you two things. I would like to say something about the proof of the theorem with the gammas. I'm not going to show you the whole thing. You don't want to see it, but I will show you some ideas from the proof, and I will say something about the infinite case. Okay, I think maybe I'll take a much easier version of the problems that arise in the infinite case and show you Glaser refinement in some simple context. Okay, and then that's it. Thanks. Ah, okay. So far, we don't have algorithms to do anything in the Sobolev case, except in very special cases. We think we are close to being able to produce some algorithms, but the toughest of the algorithms is the outlier algorithm, and I don't know. It's too early to say whether we've got a shot at it. That's an important point. So we have algorithms for CM. So far for Sobolev spaces, we have theorems. The theorems suggest that there are algorithms, but the proof, so far the proofs of the theorems for Sobolev spaces are not entirely constructive. Yes.
What if I ask to present some other question, order or multiplication, would that be too much to ask?
Okay, so... let's see, to preserve order. The short answer is I don't know. The more elaborate answer is there are some very interesting questions which these guys have asked for a while, Bierstone and Millman, which are closely related to things that preserve order. So, again, I don't know, but I mean the questions closely related to that have been posed. In terms of preserving multiplication, as far as I know, nobody has asked, so even less do I know. My guess is that only under very restrictive conditions could it be done, but that's just an initial... I'm sorry?
Look for the log. I'm trying to say log.
Well, but then it's not linear.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. If you don't demand that it be linear, but you demand that it preserve multiplication, then you say. But I don't know. Okay, so further properties of the T. Thank you. I don't know. I'm sorry? What a very, very good question. Okay. I don't have precise values for all of them, but one of them is enormous, really enormous. So none of the algorithms that I have right now are practical because of this enormous constant. Okay. There is a particular reason for that. Let me make a vague analogy. I'm not going to try to make it to say anything precise, but just think as if the following were true. Imagine you were doing linear algebra. You were inverting a large matrix, and somehow you rescale the linear equations that you're solving in such a way that that your matrix is approximately a permutation matrix. I don't claim this is possible, but that's what you try to do. You try to make a rescaling in such a way that in each row there's one element, which is obviously the biggest one, and you hope that also in each column then there will be one element, which is obviously the biggest one. And then because you know how to invert permutation matrices, that lets you invert general matrices. That's not a very good way to do linear algebra, and it may be possible to invert matrices that way, but in practice it's going to work very, very badly. What we are doing is an analog at one step when we prove one lemma, we are doing the analog of that. And at that point, we are guaranteed to get a horrible constant simply because of the proof of one lemma. Now that lemma gets applied many, many times in a multiple induction. And so the constant we get is truly awful. And so what we need to do is to make sure that that one lemma gets a constant that is pretty reasonable. I think that in order to do that, I mean, the consequences of that will propagate to higher, you know, in a top-down view of the world, that little lemma with the troublesome enormous constant will produce consequences that will bubble up to a much higher level. So the proof will look somewhat different at the end. But in some sense, it's very clear what the source of trouble is, and one has to reorganize things a bit so that that doesn't happen. If we could do that, if we could get these constants to be reasonable, I think this would be a practical algorithm. If you look at what... So I have looked a little bit at what people actually do to fit data, and I do not claim to be an expert on what people actually do, but I have looked a little bit. And the algorithms that people use all the time are in principle much, much, much worse than this. But in practice, they produce something, whereas in practice, at least right now, this algorithm produces nothing because of the huge constants.